From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, using Tax Day as our nominal hook, we talk to the man who helped clear Wesley Snipes of tax fraud and conspiracy charges. Our real focus? What are the special challenges of representing a celebrity in court? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere. It's The Business from NPR. At the time of this taping, there were no new developments in the ongoing internecine strife between the actors' union SAG and AFTRA. Each was standing by the decision to go it alone in negotiations with the studios on a contract that expires on June 30th. SAG also reportedly was to vote this past weekend on whether members not, quote-unquote, affected by the new contract, that is, actors who don't work, will be able to vote on the new deal. More about their codependent, dysfunctional relationship on next week's show. A quick update on the recent flurry of agency defections. Nick Stevens of UTA went to Endeavor with Lisa Hallerman and Sharon Sheinwald. UTA's Jonathan Sweden went to CAA, and CAA's Michael Camacho went to UTA. Please update your Fantasy Agent League rosters now. Elsewhere, the digital revolution may not be televised, but it may be telephoned. Last week, phone company Verizon fired the first shot in a battle over video supremacy with Time Warner Cable. Yes, I know it's a phone company, and yes, I did say video. Verizon filed a federal false advertising case against the company in New York last week. Verizon, with its fancy-schmancy new fiber-optic video service Fios, offers video that's 25 times faster than the average U.S. broadband connection. In its suit, Verizon claims that TV ads for Time Warner Cable falsely imply that the Fios service requires a satellite dish, that it does not provide phone, broadband, and video service, and, most egregiously, that Time Warner Cable's dad could beat up Verizon's dad. We'll keep an eye on this case because there's bound to be lots more legal static as phone companies seek to eat the cable company's lunches. Meanwhile, the guys who make so much of the stuff we see on the web were busy blowing their horns last week. NBC Universal president Jeff Zucker announced that Hulu, the new video portal jointly created by NBC Universal and News Corporation, had completely sold out all of its advertising inventory. The bad news, as CNET noted, is that more ads are surely on the way. Zucker said efforts continue to try to convince Disney, Viacom, and CBS to join Hulu. And you can bet that with more content will come even more commercials. To add even more burden on our bursting digital pipes, news broke last week that Blockbuster is putting the finishing touches on a deal to stream films directly to your TV set. Although the company wouldn't comment, The Hollywood Reporter's Andrew Wallenstein insists Blockbuster will announce a new set-top device that will do just that sometime later this month. Finally, the strangest attack on American culture in recent years came from way south of the border last week. Venezuela's Televen network removed the dubbed version of Los Simpsons from its air, calling the animated show a bad influence on children. Taking its place, Baywatch Hawaii. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, Passenger 57 meets 12 Angry Men. When movie stars walk down the street, people often stop and call them by name. Hey, Tom, looking good. George, my man. And you can understand their familiarity. We spend so much time with celebrities in movies, on TV, chat shows, in the press, that there's a sense we actually know them. Now, King John didn't consider this fact when he codified a jury of one's peers in the Magna Carta back in 1215. But if everybody thinks they know you, how do you get a fair trial? Actor Wesley Snipes had to deal with just this issue. He was indicted for cheating the IRS out of taxes on $38 million, and a conviction could have landed him in jail for a not-so-sweet 16 years. Luckily for him, Snipes was cleared of the more serious felony charges. He was found guilty on misdemeanor charges of failing to file tax returns. Snipes has been in court more than a few times in his career, and for this crucial tax trial, he speed-dialed Bob Bernhoft, who'd successfully defended him in a 2002 paternity case. Here's Bernhoft on CNN outside the courthouse in Ocala, Florida, where the tax case was tried.
Now, Mr. Snipes has always been committed to doing the right thing, and after this trial is over, he'll make whatever amends are required. But this is a man with integrity, and he asked me to tell you that he wanted to thank the people of Ocala for their courtesy, their hospitality, and their fairness.
But we're not here to talk about the Snipes trial per se. but rather the special challenges of representing a famous client in and out of court. Bob Bernhoft is the founder of the Bernhoft Law Firm. Bob Bernhoft, welcome to the business.
Good to be here.
Let's talk about Mr. Wesley Snipes. How did you first come to work for Mr. Snipes?
A mutual friend of ours is a law professor. And when Wesley expressed real displeasure with the way the New York lawyers were handling that litigation, this law professor connected us. I think Wesley was over in South Korea with his wife and kids. And we talked for about an hour or two, and then I met him down in Isleworth in Florida, and he engaged us to get rid of the arrest warrant and get some remedy for him.
So how was the experience different from working with your regular clients?
The celebrity clients are highly creative, very intelligent, and eclectic. And so they are used to having a great deal of personal input into the business decisions that they make. Their art is their business, and their business is their art. And so it's very different from the ordinary client. They want to be involved. They want to be involved at the ground level and be involved in each and every decision-making process. And that's a bit daunting at first because attorneys aren't used to that sort of client involvement.
Mm-hmm. That runs sort of contrary to what a lot of people say about celebrities, because the usual problem is access. That is, you know, just to sort of get their attention, get them to focus on the task at hand and getting to even find them, whether you can find a number that's a direct dial that you can press a few numbers and get them. It doesn't usually work that way. Did you have a problem with access?
No. I tell you what, you want to get somebody's attention, whether they're a high-profile actor, celebrity, or a sports athlete, or a businessman, have them experience a federal criminal indictment that threatens 16 years in prison. They start paying attention, and they will focus with a sort of surgical precision that can be very daunting at first, but you have to incorporate that into your representation strategy.
Mm-hmm. What about ego? I mean, was there any sense of, you know, taxes are for little people anyway. I don't see the seriousness of this. Or how dare they treat me this way or speak to me this way? I mean, did you run up against ego at all in the defense of your client?
No, not with representing and working with Wesley. Wesley was very focused. He understood 16 years in federal prison is a life destroyer. And so he was focused on the business at hand. Again, he was intensely interested in law and strategy to the extent other clients that I would have wouldn't ordinarily be, but he was in the game from the start.
Mm-hmm. Is there an ensemble at all with these people where you sort of have to fight to get your point of view in? I mean, or where you get the sense they're getting other advice that may not even be coming from lawyers or from people who even know what's going on?
Generally speaking, you know, you have entourages and there are people in these celebrities' lives that are very important to them. They can be drivers. Believe it or not, drivers can have a great amount of influence over celebrity. They're with them all the time. Personal assistants.
You're talking about limo drivers.
Yeah, sure. Car drivers, SUV drivers, limo drivers, personal assistants, people that do security for them that perhaps they've had on their team for 10, 20 years. And these people all weigh in. And so you do have this melange of external input. And so that celebrity, by definition of who he or she is getting a variety of opinions from people that they rely upon in their other business. And so they don't just carve those people away when they have a legal problem. They tend to continue to rely upon them.
And I was going to say, when they're in business with you, that's because they're in trouble with the law and their sort of notoriety goes up so that their world gets smaller, right? I mean, they're relying on Jimmy the bartender's advice even more than usual.
Their world gets very much smaller. It becomes surreal when a high-profile celebrity like Wesley Snipes gets a federal criminal indictment. Suddenly, everything becomes more intense. Everything is more compressed. It's more intense. And so when you meet Wesley and his entourage is there, again, these are very pressurized circumstances. Everybody knows what the stakes are, by the way, because, of course, any celebrity, the economics of their business bleeds out into dozens, hundreds, and sometimes thousands of people. And the people around these celebrities are keenly aware that what's at stake for their own personal economics. So everybody wants a seat at the table. Everybody wants input.
So aside from the merits of the Snipes matter, what did you consider in whether to accept a Hollywood client, so to speak? You know, in the case of Wesley Snipes, he had hired and fired a lot of agents in Hollywood.
Yes.
And I guess there's, you know, a concern that you're going to pour a considerable amount of resources into this case, a lot of time.
Yes.
It's a high-profile kind of thing. And, you know, if you're just going to be shot out of a cannon in 10 minutes, I would think that would factor into your decision. I mean, does that enter it? Did it enter it?
It did. I mean, we always have concerns about – we don't want to get into a very aggressive piece of litigation unless we're going to be there for the full ride. That's a waste of my time and a waste of my client's money. And I think in the celebrity situation, that concern is heightened. And there were certain rumors and reported articles about litigation between certain talent agencies and Wesley Snipes. And clearly, regarding the criminal trial, he was firing his existing team of lawyers, Billy Martin et al., to hire our firm. Sure, that creates a concern.
But did you address it?
You bet we did. And we sat down and we had a man-to-man conversation. And, you know, we talked about that. But when we're in, we're in. And so I was comfortable with my discussions with Wes that we were in for the full ride. And so I went on what he told me. And I was comfortable with that. Notwithstanding whatever rumors or reputation might have preceded that, I felt I'm a good people person. I'm a good judge people. He and I had an understanding. And it worked out very well for both of us, actually.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the special challenges of representing a celebrity in court with attorney Bob Bernhoft. He recently helped clear Wesley Snipes of felony tax fraud and conspiracy charges. Let's get into the trial here for a little bit. You've been hired. You've been paid up front. Very wise. And you have access. So walk me through some of the preparations here. I mean, how granular do you get with your client? Do you talk about what to wear? How to behave? Sunglasses on, sunglasses off. You know, is there a conversation about what sort of role they should be playing? Walk me through those weeks. How much time do you spend preparing with them?
A lot of time, an enormous amount of time.
And what's enormous? Like 2 hours or
goodness, weeks.
And you're just in a room with Wesley Snipes?
In varying locations, yeah. He would come to our office in Milwaukee. The first thing that a person like Mr. Snipes as a defendant in a case like this needs to do is he needs to look at all the discovery. And we had about a million pages of discovery. Now, he doesn't have to see that all. We cull that into several thousand pages. But he needs to see, and any defendant in a case needs to see what evidence the government's going to put up on that screen. We need their input. When was that letter sent? Did you see that letter? And so we rely upon them to give us amplification of these documents that the government is going to bring in.
But it's got people to handle that, right?
I mean, no, there's no replacement for the personal commentary and involvement of a defendant in preparing his own defense. I mean, he lived through it. It was his life. And he's really the only one that can have that firsthand impression.
But I mean, most stars just don't look at that kind of stuff ever.
They do when they're facing 16 years in federal prison. Because again, I don't want to talk to his CPA. I'm not particularly interested in talking to his former lawyers. I'm not interested in talking to his agents. I need his impressions about what those documents are and what he knows about them. Because ultimately, if we call him to testify in his own defense, he's got to be able to tell us what he knows, what he's familiar with, what he's seen, what he hasn't seen.
Aha. Uh-huh. So this is really about making sure that when someone is out there performing, really, because that's what they're doing in front of a jury, that the performance be credible.
Well, not just credible, but true and accurate. I mean, we don't want to be ambushed at trial. We want to know everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that's got to get hashed out over several week period. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't do us any good to put blinders on and pretend that there isn't a series of documents that's going to come in that's negative. We have to face that.
Now, interestingly, Wesley did not testify. I mean, this was sort of the role of a lifetime, and he took a powder on it.
Yeah, it was it is always a very difficult decision about whether to have your client testify or not. Conventional wisdom says they should never testify. Government lawyers sharpen their fangs and start thinking about tasting blood when they hear that the defendant client is going to take the stand. Cross-examination can be ruthless and brutal. And I'll tell you, trials are combat and there's blood on the floor. And so you have to be very, very careful about calling a client regardless of how skilled an actor he is. So we prefer not to call our client defendants to take the stand. We made that decision in this case. It's a difficult decision, though.
Why prepare him then? Because he could wind up on the...
Yeah, we don't know whether or not one of our clients is going to testify until the conclusion of the government's case.
Now, you mentioned the jury. I want to talk about jury selection. When you select a jury, anybody who's had a relationship with the defendant is barred from being on that jury.
That's correct.
It's just the nature of trial by jury law. But surely every one of these jurors had some sort of relationship with Wesley Snipes just by dint of, you know, how many movies he's been in and the scope of his public persona. And I think they're kind of right when we would say that. So, you know, how do you go about finding out if their relationship might bias them?
Yeah, we do that through a process called voir dire. And we now What we're trying to do is ask questions or have the judge ask questions of the jury to reveal these biases and prejudice.
Like?
Somebody that just is starstruck over a particular celebrity, somebody that is really anti a particular celebrity because they played a role that they were offended by. So the questioning process, and the court did a good job in this case, jury selection took 2 full days.
Mm-hmm. And some of the questions, I mean, would somebody ask, like, you know, how do you feel about vampires?
Oh, how do you feel about Wesley Snipes? Have you seen his movies? What do you feel
about
him?
Blade?
Oh, absolutely.
Should he have made Blade 3?
Well, that's another
– Was that kind of derivative?
The judge didn't ask that question.
No.
He could have asked that question, though. But you know, those are the precise types of questions that we asked.
And you know, from the other table across the courtroom, is the defense saying, well, you know, this juror clearly is a fan of Blade, has the Blade lunchbox, has the Passenger 57 ashtray or whatever it is. We don't want him on there. Can they move to get rid of someone based on that?
They can. Claude, what you have is you can move to strike any juror, both the government and defense, for cause.
Mm-hmm.
If a
fan club president would be cause?
You have to be a fan club president in saying that would affect my ability to judge fairly for the government, the prosecution, as well as the defendant Snipes.
Did that happen at all?
That didn't happen. But we struck a number of jurors for cause, probably about 13, 14, 15 jurors for cause, which was very high. And then the
cause is like what?
Cause is racial bias,
mm-hmm.
Racial animus. There was some of that. Prejudice views against African Americans. There was some of that.
But nothing about celebrity.
There was some discussion of celebrity, and interestingly enough, there were several jurors that had never seen a Wesley Snipes movie. And they were telling the truth. Some of them had heard of him, of course. But this jury was really interested in the facts. They weren't interested in the celebrity drama. We expected that whole jury box, which was horizontal, you know, parallel to the defense table, that they would just stare at us. And I've seen that when I'm out in public with Wes. It happens. They looked at the judge, the witness, and the lawyer. It really was remarkable. I did not expect that. We were stunned by that. They were just interested in doing their job.
You know, I wonder, you know, I think back to trials like the Martha Stewart trial, and it makes me wonder if juries often don't want to see celebs fall hard.
We want those jurors off of our juries, and the way we figure out how that works is through jury focus groups. And so we will engage third-party contractor companies, and we take people right from that community, and we conduct focus groups. And what we start to see is we start to see indicia of hostility towards either our defense or our client. It'll be pretextual sometimes. For example, mm-hmm. one of the critical touchstones we saw, anybody in our jury focus groups who started to minimize their exposure to pretrial publicity turned out to vote aggressively for conviction after they heard the prosecution and defense case. And so,
meaning they were preparing themselves to sort of get on this jury justice.
They were deliberately minimizing their exposure to pretrial publicity. One gentleman would say, oh, I think I saw a couple articles on that. I didn't see much, though. You know, these sorts of deliberate, you could tell they're deliberately minimizing. And then all of a sudden, you know, guilty as sin in the focus groups. So, yeah, we looked at that as a proxy for hostility to our defense and hostility to our client.
So if someone says, well, you know, I've canceled my subscription to Us Weekly and I got rid of my broadband, I don't look at TMZ anymore, that might be a reliable indicator that this is somebody who's hoping to really get their teeth into conviction.
Well, Claude was a little tough about this particular jury pool as a lot of them were not really media savvy. A majority of them did not regularly go on the internet, and they watched like one or two local stations. So we had a bit of an insular jury. But our proxy was people who would deliberately, cavalierly dismiss how much they'd seen about it. I mean, you have to understand, this is Ocala. This trial was huge news. It was all over the radio, all over the TV, the talk shows. I mean, nobody who was alive in Ocala didn't know that trial was going on.
After a short break, more with attorney Bob Bernhoft about the special challenges of lawyering a celebrity. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Fame has its good points and its bad points. Some of those bad points become readily apparent if you're famous and accused of a crime. First, if you're accustomed to nothing but sycophancy and adoration, it may be hard to grasp the seriousness of the charges against you. Second, if you're unpopular with the public, can you say Martha Stewart? The jury may be out for blood. The frenzy and publicity around the trial can make getting an objective jury almost impossible anyway. Wesley Snipes and his team had to deal with all these issues when he was accused of cheating the IRS out of millions of dollars. Here's CNN audio from outside the courthouse in Ocala, Florida.
Is he going to talk?
Wesley's not.
Is he a coward or is he going to talk?
Wesley,
are you going to be a brave guy and step forward?
Wesley's not going.
Coward? Hey.
Snipes could have landed in jail for a considerable amount of time. Luckily for him, he was cleared of the more serious felony charges. Maybe it wasn't luck, since he called in some big legal muscle, namely criminal tax attorney Bob Bernhoft. We're talking to Bernhoft about representing a celebrity client in and out of court. Now, you were a PR guy before you became a tax attorney, right?
Yeah, I did some public relations, advertising, sales, that sort of thing,
okay.
Sure.
So you know a thing or two about this. I also know that you had a guy from Citric, which is the crisis public relations firm in Hollywood.
Indeed.
Down there 24/7 throughout the trial.
Yes.
Let's talk about this court of public opinion.
Yes.
You're sort of fighting two battles simultaneously because this is a media circus in Ocala. This is the only game in town. We'd never seen a celebrity before. How do you work that front?
You work that front by bringing pros in to manage it. It's inescapable. You've got the truth inside the courtroom. You are dealing with two different worlds, and you've got the truth on the street. And there was some vicious misinformation that went on pre-trial and during the trial about the case, and you've got to fight that. You've got to fight that battle. And the only way to do that is to bring in PR media pros like Citric, who is on the ground, who knows the various media people, who's credible, who's not, and who's doing a good, fair job. And you have to manage that.
Did you advise him to talk to the press?
We were very careful about having Wesley speak to the media specifically. We advised mostly against that. We don't want him out there talking about that case. We want that case tried in the courtroom, and we'll manage the media with professionals like Citric to make that work for us.
Did he listen to you?
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, he did. He listened in every critical key piece of advice that we could offer. He listened. He understood that this was a huge stage. It's a huge stage in this itty-bitty town. You know, they called it all the pundits called it the unwinnable case and the impossible place. But at the end of the day, that's not the way it worked out.
Especially in celebrity cases, the government usually has a high incentive to avoid the media circus that we just saw go down in Florida. So I guess what I want to ask you is, you know, how does the need for the government to save face enter your strategy? And, you know, is it harder to get a celebrity to assume a humble pose to make that deal?
A great constellation of questions. The rules are sort of off. The old rules that we used to operate under with the U.S. DOJ Tax Division policy 5-6 years ago, where there were a lot of pre-indictment discussions about non-indictment dispositions, creating situations where maybe there's a misdemeanor plea and a payment of a significant amount of tax, these sorts of alternative dispositions, those aren't on the table anymore.
Because we're broke, right?
Well, it's not about being broke. It's about hanging big scalps at the top of big polls. And there was no question that the government thought this was a 100% slam dunk win case. And they were going to be able to demonstrate to America that if you hold these beliefs and you engage in this sort of conduct, even if you're Wesley Snipes with his name value and his resources, that's a conviction. And we're going to throw you in prison for 15, 16 years. So there wasn't too much of a chance at a non-trial disposition in this case. This was prosecution, trial, all the way. The government played for keeps.
Bob Bernhoft is the founder of the Bernhoft Law Firm of Milwaukee and now Malibu. He just successfully defended Wesley Snipes against the government's case for tax fraud and conspiracy to commit tax fraud. Bob, thanks for being on the business.
Thank you, Claude.
A postscript. After Wesley Snipes was cleared of felony charges of tax fraud and conspiracy, he summarily fired Bob Bernhoft. He's hired another firm to handle the penalty phase, dealing with the less serious misdemeanor charges of failing to file tax returns. Oh, fickle celebrity. We have so many entertainment options these days. The studios and theater owners are always looking for a new gimmick to keep us coming back to the movies. Their newest gimmick is, well, actually an old gimmick, and one we're going to talk about a lot more on the show in the future. Matt Holzman has the story in Smell-O-Vision.
Last month, people from the movie theater business descended on Las Vegas for the annual confab known as Show West. Theater owners get together to talk about the challenges facing their business. The studios show up touting their upcoming films, and companies that supply everything from projectors to popcorn set up shop on the trade show floor, hoping to land that big contract. Industry trade papers tend to cover the breakout sessions and the keynote speeches, but you'll find the big stories at Show West on the trade show floor. I can describe this year's big story in two words: 3D. Yes, like the monsters and the stereoscopic films of yesteryear, 3D is back with a vengeance.
Ah! Creature from the Black Lagoon. Startling beyond belief in the screen's first underwater 3D thrill.
To give you an idea about how much 3D stuff was going on at Show West this year, at one point walking the trade show floor, a man grabbed me, opened a curtain, and shoved me inside a tent like a carnival hawker.
Taste it on one more big screen.
Oh, in here?
Yeah, Beowulf.
They were showing the recent hit Beowulf in 3D. The man who grabbed me was a representative of the Korean company Master Image, one of maybe a dozen companies hawking 3D films or technology at this year's Show West. Dolby Labs was another one.
Yeah, this is not a passing trend. We're looking at an escalation.
Jeff McNall is cinema product manager at Dolby.
Phenomenal escalation of 3D releases. Last year we saw a few. This year we're seeing maybe half a dozen. 2009, you'll have probably 3D features every other month. In fact, you'll have 3D collision weekends.
In fact, DreamWorks Animation announced all their movies would be 3D starting in 2009. But with only 1,000 screens currently capable of showing 3D, that's going to be a problem. DreamWorks has already delayed the release of How to Train Your Dragon from 2009 to 2010 because its opening would have been caught between two other 3D releases, A Christmas Carol with Jim Carrey and James Cameron's Avatar. But why all this multidimensional craziness now? Well, for one, because they can. Digital projection is slowly becoming the norm in American theaters, and digital does 3D great. But more to the point, although movie revenues are up, movie admissions are down, and the theaters and the studios are trying to get people back into the Cineplex. Naysayers on Wall Street believe the movie industry is dying, but 3D stands to reestablish the experience premium of moviegoing, one analyst said recently in the LA Times. And so far, 3D has proved to be a pretty good bet. Disney's Meet the Robinsons came out last year in both 2 and 3D and averaged 3 times more per screen in 3D. And The Polar Express and the latest Harry Potter film made good money in 3D re-releases. Of course, big numbers at the box office don't take into account the higher cost of making 3D movies and the maybe $100,000 per screen it costs to convert theaters. Exhibitors believe they can charge more for tickets to 3D films, maybe as much as $5 more a pop, to recoup that cost. Startup costs would be irrelevant anyway if 3D was here to stay. The problem, of course, is that the novelty of 3D will wear off sooner than later. People get used to new technology. Nobody goes to the theater anymore because they're in color, right? I'm also concerned that, like all those computer-generated effects that were supposed to save the business a decade ago, this will be another technical distraction from the real problems with modern movie making. After all, 3D can't make characters and stories that are one-dimensional any more interesting.
Creatures on the Black Lagoon.
For the business, I'm Matt Holzman in Las Vegas.
Astounding in 3 dimensions.
And that's the business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.